Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and we've got Mr. Dave Karate Chop Martino.
I'm back.
Karate
back
Chop.
Back for the attack.
You like that, eh? Karate Chop.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, so what's going on over there, like on the East Coast? Anything exciting? Any new developments or anything?
Just weather.
Weather?
It's like cold, it's rainy, it's snowy in some spots. It's terrible.
You get 70 degree weather where you are.
Well, yeah. Well, I deserve it. No. That's crazy.
Yeah, well, that's true, Al. You do.
Yeah. You know, I'm old. I don't have much time. Yeah. So make it right. Nice for me and the dog. You know, I don't have much is on the way out here. Okay, let's see. Let's just jump into it because I know we got a guest waiting, so we can, you know, banter later. Yeah. So now we're going to be talking about a book that's just come out. It's called Lilith, and the author is with us, and that's Eric Rickstad. So thank you for being here, Eric.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it. Good to talk to you guys.
So Eric, now this is not your first book. You've been around. Not saying that you've been around, but you've been around. where did you get the incentive to actually write, period? How did you get into writing?
Okay. Yeah. So I've always been a reader, you know, since I was very young, you know, since I started to read really pretty early, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years old, and just always loved to read. I read, I'll date myself, Encyclopedia Brown and some of the early Judy Blum and Roald Dahl, Danny Champion of the World. And just was, you know, one of those kids absorbed by books, just nose in a book and always reading. And I always thought, how do they do that? How did I just read something, just words strung together, and I was scared to death, or now I can't sleep and I'm afraid of the dark, or laugh so much, or get upset, or whatever it might be, or, you know, five things at once. You know, what's going on here with this magic trick? So I'd always been intrigued by how that happened, and would write a lot of stories when I was young, and was part of a fifth grade literary luncheon that we had in the principal's office with our bagged lunch, talking Roald Dahl, a bunch of, you know, eight, nine-year-olds. And my mother was a big storyteller, and she loved film noir, and she worked at the hardware store, and they were always telling stories at the hardware store, and I would tell stories, and we'd get in trouble for telling stories because one time the police showed up. They showed up at our door because I was joking around and making up stories that my friends realized were stories, but the people next to us did not realize. My mom said maybe you should just keep to writing them down on the page so that way people will at least think they're made up. So that's where it started very early on.
So did you ever get your criminal record eliminated, or did it interfere with your writing?
I did. I had it scrubbed. It might help with some credibility.
Oh, of course. You know, then you know it's real. Hey, listen, so did you have some sort of thing that gave you confidence to actually decide that you wanted to publish the books? And especially in these times now, because everybody has access to you, you know, with reviews and comments, and people, you know, they're pretty nasty overall, right? So, you know, you're exposing a lot of things in your mind, and you put it down in a book, and then people can say or do whatever. Was there some sort of thing that gave you courage to go forward?
I just was so consumed with that, the actual writing part, that for a long time I didn't even think about the publishing end. Was just, you know, happy writing. Like I said, I started really young, so I didn't really think about it till probably college age. And when I wrote my first novel, Reap, you know, I was encouraged by professors along the way, and teachers and other writers, and they always had sort of good feedback. And I was lucky that my first novel was, you know, sort of picked up right away. But along the way, since, you know, I mean, yeah, you get beat up every day. If you were to go online, you know, I've had plenty of people say, I can't write, and I write like a 4-year-old, which, you know, hey, I started when I was 4, so maybe I haven't changed all that much. But it was sort of just, you know, now I have these stories. And for a long time when I was writing my first novel, I didn't even dare say I was writing a novel because, you know, who isn't, right? Like, oh, yeah, what are you doing? Oh, I'm writing a novel. Oh, good for you. It was just one of those things where I, you know, started to get a short story taken here or there after, you know, a lot of submissions, and have sort of learned to, you know, put blinders on to people that just don't like my writing for whatever reason. And that's fine. And you just sort of have to shut that out. It can be brutal if you let it be. But I think most of us, you know, have enough. We find our readership, hopefully, and the ones that appreciate what you write and how you write it. So and just keep going.
I personally find them, hunt them down, get their name.
Yeah, yeah. I have people. And, yeah. I have people that handle that.
So. You have people. My yeah, people will talk to your people.
I have friends that old friends that will do anything for a 12-pack. So
yeah, wow, that's great. Yeah. That's yeah.
We work cheap, yeah. Very cheap.
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, you know, hey, someone's got to do it, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I get people, well, you get people. You know, I've had people. Yeah. The same book will say one star, and it's this is written by grade 10. And the next person says this is the best book ever. So,
yeah,
you know, yeah. if you focus on your writing, that's the best thing.
I just get the best thing. It is just know. Keep focused on the writing. It really yeah. is.
Yeah. That noise just takes you off track, right?
And writing and publishing are just two entirely different things. You know, they're just the writing is what it's about, and you hope things work well with the publishing, and you get to speak about the book, and the book finds an audience, but. The real joy and pleasure is in the writing itself.
And marketing's terrible. You have to talk to people like me.
Yeah, it's just awful.
That's the hardest thing. I can't stand talking to myself, so I couldn't imagine doing that. But so the new book, Political Fiction is what it's listed as, and it came out in March 19th of this year, so it's fairly
yeah.
new.
Yeah, this is a pretty good
show. Let's talk about this, Lilith. So where did it come from? What led you into this story?
So it's a difficult story. You know, it's, it revolves around early on a school shooting. It involves a young boy, and his mother who are the central characters. His mother is the central character and she's a single mom and she's also a teacher. And they suffer a school shooting at the beginning. Really for me, I'm a parent. I have two kids, eight-year-old boy and 13-year-old daughter. And, you know, 9 years ago when I brought my daughter to pre-K, we live in a very small Vermont town. We all know each other. I go to drop her off and, you know, there's a sign next to the door that says, do not enter school if red or blue lights are flashing. I'm like, huh, okay. Well, I'm not naive, you know, but it sort of struck a nerve. Like we're in a very small, we all know each other. So what is the expectation here? And this is about, clearly about a gunman coming into the school. It's about a potential of a school shooting. And then we go to enter the school and we have to be buzzed in. You know, we have to look at the CCTV camera and make sure we are, you know, safe to let in, and we get buzzed in. And then I find a month later that, you know, my 5-year-old daughter is practicing lockdowns for slaughter. And it really just started to hit home. And sort of the central question I had is, how did we arrive here as a society? You know, how did we reach this point where it's become rote to just practice for kids getting slaughtered by military-grade guns more often than not. And it bothered me that no one's doing anything at the highest levels to do what we can anyway to prevent it. And I just started mining it and working it and thinking, you know, there's outrage after outrage piled on for victims of shootings, you know, to the extent now that you have people just outright lying and say these shootings never happened. I couldn't imagine the pain involved in someone that's experienced it or had their kids experience it to have all of this on top of it and then no one doing anything. And I thought, what if a woman who's had enough, a mother who has had enough, decided to use gun violence herself toward those who basically tacitly condone it? What if it is, you know, one of these figures that we see in the extreme media all the time that becomes the victim? What if it's a man who's out there with the thoughts and prayers, but a Second Amendment extremist that she targets and totally undoes the myth of a good man with a gun. And I just went from there. And for a long time, I didn't know if I should write it or if I could write it because it's such a difficult, sensitive subject matter. And I had to find the right narrative and the right voice. Luckily, it seems like I did because the first 2 weeks have been extraordinarily positive feedback from readers and reviewers across the board. Librarians, teachers, superintendents, principals have contacted me and said, you know, this is a really difficult book, but we're glad it's out there. So that part's rewarding.
Did the NRA give you a good review?
Yeah, I'm sure. It's coming.
Well, you know, because I've had Alex Jones, like the whole Alex Jones thing covered, you know, with some of the Columbine parents that had been, you know, put through what he did to them, right?
Oh.
And his cronies, right? It was terrible, right? Yeah. And so it's a very hot topic and people just, they're not really negotiable. You know what I mean? They have
a
point of view. That's it.
It's a shame because we've gone from people in position to make a difference, you know, politicians, legislators, arguing over policy to, you know, the last 10, 15 years, just culture war. Nothing is about policy. Nothing is about moving anything forward. And I think that's part of the frustration, like with this particular character, is so many things could be done that are reasonable. I own guns. See, that's so people want to come at me. It's like, I've owned guns my whole life. I live in Vermont. I'm a hunter. So I see it from that perspective. I see how poorly certain men behave, especially concerning their guns. They just never mature. They never grow up, frankly, you know. There's a lot of things I'm totally in support of. You know, get rid of AR-15s. There's two types of guns that are made, those for hunting and maybe like sporting clays, and those that are made to kill human beings. And there's no in between there. You know, I have the ability to speak toward it from a point of view where, you know, I'm a gun owner, but the NRA just, you know, they're full of it. They're full of it. I could take them count by count. And they just propagate lies, and they propagate fear. All in the name of selling more guns.
Yeah, it's completely a business. And it's really sad, actually, because people, year after year goes by, and more people get shot, more people die, more suffering.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't, you know. I mean, there's no perfect answer, but it would certainly help to have a better, let's say, regulation, you know, review.
There is no solution that's going to end everything there for anything. But as a society and as our representatives and our government, there are plenty of things that we can do to do our part. You're not going to eliminate every rogue person. You're not going to eliminate every incident, but to be able to get to a point where we say we've done all we can, where no one's rights are infringed upon, and there's plenty we can do, plenty we can do to not infringe on anybody's Second Amendment rights and still make guns harder to get for certain people that have criminal records or domestic abuse records or serious mental health issues or all kinds of things we can do that are totally reasonable. And like you said, so many people are just not, they don't even want to, they're not even prepared to speak about solutions for the sake of our kids and ourselves. I mean, it's not just kids at school. It's cross your fingers when you go to the movies tonight or, you know, the carnival or, you know, that, you know, something doesn't happen. You know, and it's a uniquely American problem.
I always wonder about that because, you know, all of the other, you know, like Canada, UK, Australia, but there is a really strong gun regulation, right? You know,
right.
And, you know, you go to the RCMP, they do their check, and then they also scan your care card, which is your medical card. And if you have any sort of mental issues or any of you going through any issues or on drugs, they're going to question you. It's just, it's not a free reign, that's all. But people have as many guns in these countries.
Right.
So there's something else going on. And it's.
Yeah. Lilith deals a lot with, as the more I wrote it, it's called Lilith for a reason. The main character's name is Elizabeth, but she uses the name Lilith when she enacts her own shocking act of violence against this gun shop owner and his cronies. To make a statement, uses gun violence to raise awareness of gun violence to those who somehow think thoughts and prayers are enough. It delves into the mythology of guns in the United States in particular and how it's been propagated for 100 years through movies and TV and pop culture. And a lot of it's fine. A lot of it's okay. You understand. I'm not saying that leads to violence, but it's part and parcel of this mythology of the strong man and the gun in America that, you know, you have a problem, you go out in the street, you know, how classic is the gunfight in the street in American film for 50 years. And there's sort of this Americans, you know, they won the West with guns, and guns are the answer, and violent men being violent as a man is okay and condoned. And all of those things that breed it's a hotbed for this type of culture to sort of thrive in, that the gun is an extension of your manhood or extension even of virility or extension of, you know, whatever else. And it gives you power and damn it, it's mine, you know, and you're not going to take it. And so it's uniquely American in a lot of ways, and the free reign in which people can get guns, certain types of guns. You know, as a hunter, I have to take a hunter safety course. Anyone who's wants to hunt with a weapon has to take a very, very strict hunter safety course over weeks. Even if you're a kid that wants to go out with, you know, your father or mother and just sort of be in the woods with them or whatever, you have to take, you know, it's weeks long. There's a written test. There's a hands-on test for safety, for how to handle it, how to load it, how to care for it, how to, all of the things you should have to do before handling a deadly weapon. As a hunter, you need to pass all these stringent tests. And if you don't pass it with like 90% and higher, it's not just, oh, I got a 60. That's great. Well, go take your, you know, you have to pass it with a 90% because you can kill someone or wound them forever. But you can go in a store. If it's not for hunting, all bets are off. You can pick up a, I've never handled a gun before in my life, but I want an AR-15 and a 9mm handgun because, boy, those look cool. And you can just go in and buy them and walk out. It's like buying a motorcycle.
Yeah, I saw it on TV. It was fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're not toys, you know?
No.
And there's a lot of kids being killed, you know, other than mass shootings and school shootings. There's so many people that die because of lack of just responsibility that you should have to learn before you leave a store with one of these.
Yeah, yeah, we need to take more care. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you chose, okay, so now you're kind of, your character is the mother, and I guess it's in, you know, she's the voice, and she deals with all of the, you know, the things that she did and the things that happened and yeah, and stuff. How do you get into the mindset of a female lead character and the emotions and everything tied up of being a mother? Was it a struggle?
It was a struggle to a point, for sure. It was a struggle to find the voice and her particular voice. I come from the place of, you know, of a parent myself and being around, you know, my wife, my kids' mothers, and that ongoing fear we live in the society, you know, so many people have been affected by it. And so I wrote from just, you know, it's sort of incumbent upon me as the author to sort of get as close as I can to it. So I went from my own emotions, and sat with it for a long time. You know, as a writer, I sat with this issue and the fallout of shootings and all of it for a long time. And so when I think of, probably most people were sort of, most people would have to be forced to sit with an issue like this, and think about it and dwell on it. It really starts to go deeper and deeper. And so it came out in that way. And I was raised by a single mom from the age of 8 on, and I had 3 sisters. So it was my mom and a younger sister and 2 older sisters. So I had like a firsthand perspective of girls' interaction with other boys and even girlfriends of theirs, and all the things that they have to endure, you know, from every age of, you know, from 6 to, you know, to now still. So I did have a little bit of a, I wouldn't say inside track, but I was around girls and women my whole life and not around, you know, at least in the household. So it's a little bit easier maybe for me to tap into that, perspective, because, you know, I have a lot of conversations with my sisters and, you know, they shared a lot with me as a brother about things you wouldn't think of necessarily, about what wounds them and what oppresses them or what makes them fearful, you know, just by someone saying something or looking at them the wrong way or treating them in a certain way. And that's all tied into the gun violence, because not one school shooter has been a boy, has been a girl or a woman, not one. K through 12 school shootings are all committed by boys or men, period. All mass shootings, 98.6% of them are men. So I just tapped into my humanity, short answer.
Well, yeah. No,
you know,
yeah,
we all feel that. And if you sit with it long enough, like, how are we here? And then as I was writing it, I was hoping something good would happen and I actually wouldn't have to finish it. Like something would happen down in D.C. that at least was steps forward. You know, we do what we can and we can't account for certain things, but we've done what we can. So that's good, but it just hasn't happened. It's only gotten worse. I can't count the shootings that have happened in 10 years.
So in this particular book, you've written a lot of books before. How is it different? I mean, in the point of character, like you obviously had kind of the idea of the story before you really developed the characters, I'm guessing, in this. Is that sort of a different way of approaching writing for you?
My approach is very much organic. I have something that's bothering me or interests me or kind of gets my attention, and it doesn't go away. You know, a lot of ideas come and go, and I'll start with an image. And this was an image of someone outside of a gun shop who's, for one reason or another, going to exact some sort of retribution against, you know, these real, you know, frankly, scumbag people that are propagating these lies and just don't care. All they want to do is profit off of death and profit off of guns. And that was the image. But I approach most novels the same way and feel my way around, you know, knowing that whatever is bothering or whatever image that initiated it will carry me through for a novel. Sometimes that image never makes it into the book, or sometimes, like in this case, it's 100 pages in. But I did have to find a certain language for it. I rewrote it. Dozens of times. I mean, it took me a decade. I wrote 3 books and published 3 books in the time that took me to write this one particular book, because the subject matter I just wanted to handle with as much sensitivity and empathy as I could muster and emotion, but also not hold back. In some ways, you will not see any children being shot in this book. It wasn't appropriate. And I had to find my way to write that and not show that, which I didn't feel was appropriate. I felt like if you were sort of there at the school, but just hearing things, and you know, that would be enough. People's imaginations could fill it in. But so that was the most difficult, find the voice and the way to write it. The language is very economical and very spare, and I try to get the most out of every word to you know, find sentences. And sometimes there's only one word on a page, so in that way, it's very different from a more conventional approach, stylistically.
Well, you mentioned image. What about audio? Can you hear your characters? Do you have an inner monologue when you're writing, or even when you're writing prose? Is that how you create dialogue and prose itself, or do you have another way?
Yeah, that's how I, you know, there's always something spinning in my head and a monologue going on, you know, and a lot of times the best things I'll arrive at, the linchpins of novels I'll arrive at, when I'm not writing. You know, I might be walking our beagle, or I might be mowing the lawn, or I might be, you know, painting our house or something like that. But the wheels are going, you know, and sometimes I'm aware of them and sometimes I'm not, but then something will click, you know, or I'll literally be, you know, my kids are like, you're always talking to yourself again. You know, why? I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not talking to myself. And they're like, you were just talking to yourself. I said, I guarantee you it wasn't me I was talking to. You know, I'm working stuff out in my head. So yeah, there's a dialogue going on a lot, or a monologue, where once I found that voice for this book, it's present, and sort of invasive almost, you know, speaking to me, where, you know, I'll come in from mowing the lawn and tell my wife, hey, you remember that part I was working on? I think I got it. And she'll be like, thank God you got it. I'm tired of hearing you talk about not getting it. But she doesn't say that. We don't need to say certain things. We just know. So yeah, I do. There's a monologue in the head. There's a dialogue. Once I find that voice and those floodgates open, which sometimes I feel like I'm just with the characters, and I'm just trying to write fast enough to keep up with them. I don't know, when she goes into the gun shop, I assumed she was going to be entering the shop at night to meet this one particular gun shop owner, who's the most infamous gun shop owner in the land. And he comes on all the right wing shows, and he's like, imagine Alex Jones that also owns the most renowned gun shop in the world. That's who this guy is. And I expected her to be invited into this gun shop, where she wants to get this guy. And she opens the door and there's four other guys with him that she didn't expect. And that just happened. And I'm just like, damn, now she's in a real situation. She did not expect there to be five armed men to contend with in this situation. So it becomes, it's great because when I feel a certain uneasiness because I've discovered this along the way, I know the reader will feel it too when they open that door. And it's not just one guy, but five.
And violence. Now, considering the meaning, the message in the book, how do you handle writing the violence? Like, how do you display that on the page?
Right. Yeah. So with the school, you know, again, I wanted to be very, very sensitive to it. And in fact, you know, on the cover, it says, you know, mother, hero, villain, killer. And she's a hero at first and remains a hero to many. I won't give anything away. But right in the very beginning, you know, she's a school teacher. And it's the day they're actually practicing lockdown and they're done with that. And then this gunman arrives and they can hear the shots out in the hallway. And the lockdown protocol in this country is called lockdown for a reason, which makes no sense to me. You know, one, it sounds like, you know, when you think lockdown, you think of a prison lockdown, you think of being trapped, which is what happens. They practice locking themselves in their classrooms and just sitting there waiting for the gunman to come. Not like, let's get out of here. And there was one incident where someone pulled a fire alarm so people would run out and that gunman could shoot people as they fled. And that's what lent to this policy, but it's never been done again or it hadn't been done before. But it's a horrible situation. Feel like, okay, we'll just sit here and lock ourselves in this room and wait, hope he doesn't arrive in this room. So she saves her class by fleeing with them. And getting them out, she breaks protocol. So you don't see any children subject to gun violence there, but she does go back into her to get her son because he's in an older class. She teaches kindergarten. He's in second or third grade. And she goes into his class in the aftermath of that classroom being shot up. And I don't describe anything with specificity, more just her feeling detached and her like vomiting and her, you know, maybe a foot slipping in blood or something, but I don't describe bodies. I don't describe, you know, cause it's haunting enough until she finds her son hidden in a art room, you know, in art closet. So that's nonetheless, it's still very, very traumatic. But when she goes into the gun shop to exact revenge, I don't hold back. Because I want these men and the reader along with them to finally feel what it's like to be on the other end of the gun that they covet so much, thinking that all they need is a gun and they're safe, not recognizing that even when they're all armed with this woman there, when she pulls a gun out from behind her back and they're not expecting it, all bets are off. Because when you're not expecting it, it doesn't matter how well armed you are. Someone has the upper hand and it takes seconds, literally seconds. So in that, I wanted to charge up the violence and to really show it. And so I don't really hold back there.
But how do you get the dialogue of a lot of those characters? Because, you know, frankly, it doesn't sound like you're any of those types of characters. So how do you kind of make it so that it's very realistic on the opposing side?
You know, unfortunately, you know, I have, you know, even friends who think a certain way about guns, who make jokes about guns and violence. And, you know, it's, so it's, you know, people I know pretty well that, you know, have a callousness toward anything that doesn't happen directly toward them or that somehow they're so steeped in this, absolutism regarding the Second Amendment that any little thing is stomping on the rights when it's not. So I'm around it. I've been in gun shops. You know, the last time I was ever in a gun shop was the other half of this equation, which was around the time I, you know, brought my daughter to pre-K for that first time. And it was, I hadn't been in a gun shop in a long time. And it was used to be just some hunting, you know, some shotguns, maybe a couple handguns, mostly for sportsmen or women, you know, looking to go you know, hunt deer or ducks or whatever. And I walked in and it was nothing but black guns and long guns and, you know, clips that hold, you know, 50 rounds and tripods for shooting people along. You know, they're weapons for killing people. They're not weapons for hunting. There's only two types of guns, the weapons for hunting and weapons for killing people. And the ones that are made to kill people, the only reason a new one is made is to do it faster and more efficiently. And so I've been around people like that. And so it's not a stretch. I've heard it everywhere. And if you get online and look at some of these sites, which I had to force myself to do, it's vile. It's so repugnant, some of the things that are said on these certain websites about how they think their rights are being infringed and they're the victims. And it's a war. And she sort of, that's sort of part of what spurs her too, is she gets on one of these websites and figures that, you know, they keep saying it's war, they're taking our right, you know, it's war, be ready. And she thought, okay, if they want a war, I'm going to bring it to them and see how prepared they really are for throwing this rhetoric around.
So this book took you quite a while to write, if I understand, in that. And you seem to be quite, you're immersed in it. It's very important to you and stuff like that. So how do you think this has changed you, this whole process, or has it?
It definitely has. You know, I've looked at other ways, you know, what people could do to, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, it's a very taut and suspenseful book, and it brings up a lot of emotions for readers. And readers, you know, reviewers have read it, you know, just really thought it was a necessary book. But it's changed me in that, you know, made me really think, how do we get out of this mess? Because it's one of the first things is when she has to practice lockdown as a teacher, how did we get here? I don't accept this. I don't accept this. We're in this spot. You know, one of her kids says, did you have lockdowns when you were a kid? And she's like, no, we didn't. She's like, how come? And she's like, I don't have that answer. I don't know what happened, but something happened. When did it become, you know, a school shooting become divisive? You know, so I was thinking, you know, we got to stop. One of the things that changed and reflected on more, we got to stop the culture war and start the policy war and have it be about policy again and have people be aware of organizations like Moms Demand Action and Everytown that are trying to act on things they can act on and get things done that are perfectly reasonable, like, you know, banning assault weapons or banning, you know, bump stocks that turn already assault weapons or semi-automatics into fully automatic weapons, which are illegal. But we have a hard time even doing that. Or ghost guns, or 3D printer guns, you know, that are just untraceable. All these really pragmatic things that you could start with. So it's changed me in that way. And it's just made me much more, even more aware of all of the things that teachers face, you know, every day. They should not have to be thinking for one second, I have to prepare my kids for mass slaughter. How absurd is that? It's absurd. So it's changed me in that way and allowed me to speak about something I'd always been passionate and unnerved by and angered by. But in working on it, it's changed me in that I can come up with maybe ways to address it. People have signed up for these organizations after reading this book, which pleases me a lot.
And so that, I guess that would be kind of your subtext or your goal or your meaning that people take away from the book.
Yeah, and I wasn't aware of it at the time. It's only been in response from readers, you know, leading up to the release of the book when you have, you know, advanced readers copies out. I had no idea how people were going to react. You know, what's this? He's a man writing a woman. Why he didn't do it well enough. You know, so many ways it could not hit the mark and not, you know, I could have failed what I tried to do. And the response has been so strong that I didn't even expect it. I didn't write it with that in mind. Like, oh, I want people. But the more I do readings and stuff, and I have a superintendent, you know, and principal of 40 years come up to me and talk to me, you know, for 40 minutes after the reading's over, or bookstore owners or teachers online, you know, be really, really struck by this book that, you know, it's sort of its own entity now. It wasn't even something that I set out to do. I just set out to write from a place of helplessness and rage and a narrative that I could handle, you know, and try to make a story out of it that would, you know, impact people, but I wasn't sure exactly how. So it's been more the last month or so that the responses made me realize, oh, this book's kind of its own thing. And if it can help awake people up or get people talking, that's wonderful. And if it's just a book that's really a taut thriller with some, you know, literary crime fiction that gets someone reading and they don't have a big takeaway from it, that's fine too. Or, you know, and some people have not liked it, which we spoke about at the beginning, you know, that this guy can't write it all.
Yeah. Well, that's just, you know, so how do you get into the mindset of the bad people in the book, the bad concept? Like when you're writing about the person that owns the gun store and he's like an Alex Jones and stuff, do you just like watch Alex Jones for a while and then kind of?
Well, I've never watched him because I don't think I could stomach him, you know, never intentionally, I should say, watched him. But I've, you know, kept, you know, I read about the trial and, you know, I don't want to be too sickened or give that type of person even more attention than they need. But the, you know, unfortunately, there's so many of them out there that it's not that, you know, they're, I have to work my way away from them being these cartoons that if, you know, when you think about it, you can't even believe that these people are that vile, that they could exist, that they could say this about kids that were slaughtered, you know, and say it to their parents' face and profit off of it. So, you know, I had this mother when she's in the ICU with her son, not sure if he's ever going to wake up from the medically induced coma he's in, that there's a TV on in the cafeteria. There's a TV on in ICU, and it's this Alex Jones type. It's this type vomiting this filth after yet another school shooting that happens while she's still in the ICU after a week, you know. And it's not hard to write these people because they're given such a vocal platform to begin with. It's just outrageous. They're everywhere, and they're just in the ether. Their talking points and their lies, and so unfortunately they weren't all that difficult to write.
So what's next for you? How are you coming out of this? Are you working on another project, or are you taking a break now?
Yeah, well, I have two books that are done. I'm not sure which would come first. We might do them together, or what, you know, the appropriate book is to follow this one. And I have a collection of short stories that's done. And then I'm working on a, you know, another novel that's probably 2/3 done. So I'm always working on something. But with those done, you know, I look forward to finishing this other one that I'm working on. I'll have three novels done and a collection of short stories. And, you know, maybe I'll focus a little bit more on coaching my son's little league this spring than I had last, without mumbling to myself on the mound.
So now, do you have a website, social media, places that you like readers to interact with you, or?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I have Facebook, and they're all, you know, Twitter is just Eric Rickstad, and Instagram is Eric Rickstad Author, and that's my Facebook as well. I post mostly stuff about the books, but, you know, I'll post other stuff, cakes I bake with my daughter, or flies I tied over the weekend, or my beagle doing something stupid.
Yeah, no, that's always good.
Yeah.
Dogs are good.
Dogs are
good. They're better than humans.
Yeah, they're better. They're much, much, much better.
Much better. Well, okay, we'll put all of your information up on our website, too, so people can find you, and right. Maybe even your dog. And you know, it's all good. So the book, Lilith, and the author's been with us. That's Eric Rickstad. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Eric.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.